Welcome back. We've got another edition of the Division 2 and Division 3 podcast. I am Matt Kinnear, back after a long absence, and Dan Kaplan is here as usual. Dan, it's a few days before the quarterfinal round of the NCAA Division 3 tournament, a few days before the semifinal round of the D2 tournament. Life is good, isn't it?
Man, yeah. A year ago this time, so much had been different. It is such a treat to be here, such a treat to be talking to you this morning, talking about these tournament games. And I am fortunate enough to be packing a bag, too, and getting ready to go up and go get to a site. So I am in really good shape here.
That's right. You're going up to Rochester this weekend to cover those games for Inside the Cross. How many games have you been to this year? Across, you know, not just your own, obviously, from your coaching, but in terms of covering games, how many have you been to?
So I have been to, really, I think it was just the Salisbury Cabrini game early in terms of D3 games. But just being where we are, I was able to get to all those MIA games before my high school season started. So I'd say I've been in person to like 6 or 7 games this season, but these will be definitely the like climax of that.
Yeah, it's so weird. You know, in a typical year, I'm probably at, I want to say, an average of 3 to 4 games per week. I'm covering college, and I've covered 2 of them this year.
Goodness, right. Yeah, that's crazy. Which 2 did you get?
Most of them have been, you know, I've covered a ton of them from my couch, but in person. The Penn Cabrini game.
Yeah, right. And then the Villanova game, right?
And then Villanova versus Denver.
Yes.
So, you know, kind of my second home of Philly, going up there for those games. But it's weird, man. It's tough, but... You know, there's some normalcy. You know, there's like increasing amounts of fans being allowed to these games, which is awesome. You know, it was kind of being at that Penn Cabrini game was so strange because it was at Cabrini and, you know, it was just Cabrini like parents and family there. You know, there was a few Penn parents who I guess kind of snuck in or something. But it was just so strange that it wasn't like you don't get that momentum of the crowd that you normally do. So really happy to get out there and that you're going to be out there and catching what's going to be an awesome side of the bracket this weekend. But first I want to kind of talk about your own experience with this tournament. You know, you played at York and you've gotten this far in the tournament. You've gotten to this Elite Eight part. What's the grind like? Because I know the format was different. You didn't have those games on back-to-back days, but you still had the midweek game and then the weekend game when you were playing. When you're to this point, what is it like for you as a player?
Yeah, it's really interesting because most of the, like at this point, most of them are probably done finals and stuff like that. So you're basically full-time lacrosse player where it's like you wake up, team with the breakfast with the team and get down and do some film or stuff like that. But it just becomes really fun. You're just around the team the entire time. And it's like, it's totally the expression of, your seniors and the rest of your team is just trying to make it last as long as possible. And that's when, like, that's what you see all the guys get emotional about when it ends. It's not like, oh, shoot, I'm never going to shoot lacrosse balls again. It's like, dang, this whole week with my team has been a whole lot of fun, and I really did not want that to end. I guess to answer your question in one word, it's a ton of fun.
What's the physical grind like?
Yeah, that's definitely starts to take its toll. I was like such an old man with my stuff too, where like my injuries were like back and hip. So it was like, I was literally like called old man cat for a while. And like, but it is kind of what it is. You kind of take it with, you kind of take it as it goes. And just, like I said, you kind of start to love it as part of the process. And most of the time when you're in the training room with the trainers, you're in there with a couple of the boys anyway, so you're either getting some ice baths or whatever it is, but it's just, you're just around the team, which just becomes something that you're trying to hold on to, and that's why you're fighting so hard in the games, just to make it all last.
You know, and this is like this new format, the back-to-back games, you know, the Saturday-Sunday games.
I don't envy having to do that. I'm glad I got out when I did.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like I remember talking to this is about the time that, you know, in one of those NCAA committees that like kind of the news of this started to come out. I was at Cabrini, I think, for their fall ball. And I was talking to Steve Colfer about it. And, you know, we were just talking about, like, their run to the championship. And he was just saying, like, man, like, I don't know if we'd be able to do that. You know, like, what we did if we had the back-to-back games. You know, because they would have had to play Salisbury on a day's rest, I believe.
Correct. Yep, that's correct. It would have been Saturday they played at York, won in overtime. And then Sunday would have been playing, I guess it would have been site locations, but you get my point. So it would have been turnaround. And that was a night game, so like, I'm sure they would have played it at 1 o'clock. So it would have been like, I don't know, 12 hours rest before you're getting up the next day and getting going.
Yeah, so it's like, on one hand, like, I do kind of love the idea of, like, you know, just roll the ball out there and play, like, you know, make it a player's game, not a coach's game. But on the other hand, like, particularly when the benches are smaller, you know, obviously that's been talked about a ton this year, but it's always been a problem, particularly in D3. You know, that's just not a lot of bodies to play
back. I mean, it even impacts, like, the way you warm up. Like, you have to get, like, with that little of guys, you can't just roll out and go 3v2s for 30 minutes or, like, you're just going to wear your guys out. It literally impacts every single thing. You have to think about all of that stuff. It's really interesting. It's tough to plan for. Mm-hmm. I remember one year we had one of our kids who did not play any pole, just bring a pole out for the sake of warm-up so that we could get through extra reps of, like, transition stuff early, you know. It's crazy.
We don't know who's going to win, but the one thing that we do know is that there is going to be madness. We've got awesome storylines, we got awesome teams, we got back-to-back action in the D3 bracket. Mix of newcomers, mix of the traditional powers that we have grown to know and love. May Madness is officially here. You know what else is? The Maverick EKG shoulder pads and chest protectors. They're in stock for all players. Get upgraded performance protection that meets the new Noxy safety standards. Shop the whole line at lax.com/EKG. What is the biggest, like, principle you think that these coaches are kind of, what's their guiding light in terms of this back-to-back preparation?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it's different for each game. I think York has to go into this game kind of this weekend focused on Tufts, and same thing, vice versa. I don't think either team can overlook each other there. And then obviously Lynchburg CMU is a little bit different because they're so familiar with each other. They've already played each other 3 times, so they should just already be kind of able to roll out the game plan and maybe make a few adjustments and a few manipulations and see what you can steal on them or something like that. But for the most part, the teams are already going to be pretty familiar with each other. And then the other two, in RIT and Salisbury, they have a little bit of a luxury where I don't know, like, obviously you can't overlook either team. It's not like it's impossible for either of these teams to go out there and come up with a victory somehow and scheme one up. Both teams play a little bit unique styles, and Illinois Wesleyan a little bit more so. So it's not like you can overlook them or anything. But at the same time, like, if you have 3 guys on your staff, maybe only one of them is focused on the first game while the other two are looking at the second, or vice versa, or whatever, you know. Like, you can kind of start to split it up. And that depends on your staff a little bit and exactly what you have and some of those resources. But going into those, I think you can kind of start to look at who you think you're going to be seeing on Sunday in the more important round.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, we'll start kind of talking about the games, and let's start with that Illinois Wesleyan Salisbury game. I had the pleasure of talking to Zach Iannucci this week. I'm doing a story for Inside the Cross about them making it to this point in the NCAA tournament for the first time. And in terms of scheming for a team, like, you know, there might not be a more unique team to scheme against than Illinois Wesleyan in terms of what they do, you know, heavy in transition. They basically 10-man ride at every single occasion. There's not, like, an occasion where they, like, it's not a situational thing. It's a basically all-the-time thing.
It is their ride. Ride is a 10-man.
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny, like, you know, I talked to Coach, and he was basically like, they do that the way that they, you know, the mindset of the team, the unique style that they play is kind of for this moment. You know, they are highly committed to recruiting, you know, in their region, recruiting Midwest talent. If you look at their roster, there's two guys from Pennsylvania, and that's like it in terms of East Coasters. And if I remember right, they're not even like true Pennsylvanians. They're like people who transplanted there or something. So he's like, you know, we know he used the quote, "We're the nobodies from nowhere." You know, he's got guys who played only club lacrosse in high school because they didn't have varsity programs where they're from. You know, and they're great players, and Illinois Wesleyan, you know, has a pedigree of success in terms of overall Division III sports, which is a big selling point for the university. But, you know, he's like, if we're going to compete with the Salisbury's, we're not going to out Salisbury. We got to do something different. And he made the point that, like, you look at these teams that are, you know, he was saying, you look at the four teams that are, you know, in our little quadrant of the bracket, which one's the outlier in terms of, like, the way that they do things? It's us. You know, not saying that they're going to go shock the world against Salisbury, but, you know, you're not going to play this buttoned up style and think that, like, you're going to, you know, out scheme Jim Berkman, or you're going to just like play a cleaner game than them and just be more talented at each position. That's not a realistic expectation. A more realistic expectation might be we're going to 10 man ride them, and, you know, they're going to clear at some abysmal 60% or something like that. And they've got a good face-off guy. He did play against Melanthi and kind of took it on the chin a little bit a few years ago. They've got a good goalie who his numbers are actually a little worse than they should be because of the 10-man ride, because they've been scored on so many times because of it. You know, but that's a more realistic path to victory than, say, you know, trying to play Salisbury the way that Lynchburg would play Salisbury. Like, you're just not going to be able to do that.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes a whole ton of sense. I don't know that I would be doing anything differently if that's if that was kind of my roster makeup and the guys that I had. I think it's really interesting the point you made about the goalie, because I do think he's very good in the cage, and he's part of it. He's part of the whole, I'll say, straw that stirs the drink, because he's able to make stops behind, you know, some defenses that are going to take some chances, and he's able to make some saves and then spark some transition for them too. And that's when they're really getting going. Like, they'll score in bunches, and they'll score like a 6-on-6 goal, and then they'll score off the faceoff, and then they'll lose that faceoff forward, make the save, and then score in transition. And then they just score 3 goals in like a minute and a half, and you're like, oh my God, what just happened? You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, like they're for sure like going to be, you know, again, I'm not like putting the world on upset alert. I'm just saying they're going to be a lot of fun to watch, and it's a refreshing, like, you know, it's a refreshing course of action that I think that he's taking in terms of the way that he is building his program out there.
I think if I went and watched them practice, I would just be like so unnerved the whole time. Like, they throw some of these headman passes where it's like, if you didn't throw it, I would be like clapping you up. Like, hey, that's a good decision. Like, we didn't need to throw that. You can just kind of pump fake it and keep running it yourself. You know, we'll get it down the side and, you know, get our subs on. We don't need to throw that 45-yard headman on a 45-degree angle with your offhand through traffic. But they'll do it and hit on it, and you're like, oh, my gosh. Like, it is like, to your point, it's just a really exciting brand of ball. So there's going to be something that makes you go, wow. But I don't know how many of those wows we'll have, or if it'll be enough for them to, like we said, pull off this upset.
Yeah, and they've also, you know, and I forget which assistant it was, but there was a Tufts assistant who kind of came out and, like, really sat down with their staff and helped them formulate a little bit about their mentality and their game plan. So there's, you know, there's a little bit of Tufts in there, but then it's taken to just a different level in terms of how they do things. So sticking on that side of the bracket, you know, when I think that there's you mentioned that this is going to be the third time that these teams meet. It's going to be the rubber match. Two teams that have been basically in the top 10 all year. Lynchburg's been pretty much in the top 5, probably since they beat Salisbury early in the year. Lynchburg versus Christopher Newport. I think these teams have probably been talked about to, you know, maybe the most out of all the teams that are left in the bracket. You know, obviously Salisbury is Salisbury, and they get a lot of discussion, and Tufts, you know, Tufts is Tufts, but we didn't get to see them, you know, for three quarters of the season like we had hoped. Lynchburg, Christopher Newport, what's going to be the key to this one in your eyes?
Yeah, this is going to be another fun one. I think Lynchburg is playing a really, really good brand of lacrosse right now. I think they've kind of found a rhythm and they've found an identity. I would also say that they have a couple X factors on their team that are bringing it right now, and that's kind of transitioning them and making them even better. I think CNU is also in a good spot. I think they that Pool C bid, when you get that, it kind of can revive you a little bit and inject a bit of life into your locker room. And like I said, then you're most of the guys are done finals. It's been sunny out. It's been nice. It just is like it's kind of invigorating. And then they go and they put that performance on that they did at Stevenson. And that was probably a fun trip where they're around. They were up there for a few days. I know they were up there like basically as if they were going to have played on Saturday. So they probably got to go and watch that Stevenson game in person on Saturday. Maybe not with COVID protocols. I'll backtrack that. I'll say that they probably watched it in the hotel lobby on a screen somewhere or something like that. And so they probably have been able to prepare really well just based on, you know, the full week leading into this one and the fact that they've already been familiar with them and played them a couple times. So I don't know that I can pinpoint one specific thing that wins this game for either team, but whichever team is able to come and kind of assert themselves and play their style of game is going to be who ends up winning. And so if Lynchburg can come and kind of, you know, own the 50-50 ground balls the way that they like to and push transition and, you know, they're winning faceoffs with Quentin Ritchie, it might be another game similar to the rematch that we saw. But if CNU is able to kind of withstand that and have these long possessions that they like to and then ride CNU or ride Lynchburg back and all that stuff, then we could end up seeing Lynchburg or CNU ahead. So it'll be an interesting one. It'll be a fun one. I don't know that any one specific thing wins this game, though.
I'll ask kind of a similar question, but a different way. Why did CNU win this game during the season? And then why did Lynchburg win this game during the season?
Oh, that's a good, really good one. So Lynchburg won the second one because Lynchburg won the second one. I'll say for two things. One, they adjusted to their zone offense. So the first game, the Lynchburg zone offense really struggled against the CNU zone defense. And so once they made that adjustment and they basically stopped working so much on the wings and started working a little bit more through X. And so now that CNU defense has to slough and your head is turned and now you can get cutters behind it. Which I thought was a really, really good adjustment. Whereas before, they were on the wings, and they were carrying into less dangerous space, and you could pass earlier, and it just wasn't as good for their personnel. They've also figured out a little bit more of the balance to their field, playing the lefty and Kenny. And so he's been playing basically since that game. Actually, I think since the WNL game that they lost, he's been playing since that game. And then against that zone, it really helps balance the field and give them a lefty shooter.
You know, we're going to go to the other side of the bracket, but I want to take a little bit of a detour and a departure here in terms of, you know, there's some big coaching news out there in the Division III world. So we're going to take a little intermission from, like, talking about the games to talk a little bit about the D3 coaching ranks. You know, so it's been a few weeks now that, you know, Gettysburg coach Hank Jancic announced that he is stepping down after almost four decades of coaching. And, you know, he's one of the legendary figures in the game. And, you know, his fingerprints are all over this tournament. When you look at the coaches who are left here in, you know, this Elite Eight, you obviously have Jim Berkman. And, you know, I spoke to Coach Berkman about Jancic 2 weeks ago, and he basically said, I owe my whole life to Hank Jancic. So basically all those people who are coaches who are, you know, Salisbury alums, they are part of Coach Jancic's tree, and that's a lot of coaches. You got someone like Steve Kadelka who, you know, obviously is played for and coached with Jancic. You got Brandon Childs on the other side of the bracket at York, who, you know, is someone who kind of comes from Kadelka's wing. So there's his fingerprints are all over this, and it's probably one of the most, would you say it's one of the most sought after jobs in Division III lacrosse?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
What's the, like, you know, I've talked to some people who kind of are interested, and, you know, some conversations kind of private on the record and some private and off the record and some on the record. You know, what do you imagine, what are the directions that Gettysburg can go? You know, I think the first thing would be looking at the circle of alums, I think is probably the natural thing that people are thinking. And like, do you think that makes sense in terms of just going with someone who is familiar with the program, who played under Hank, who kind of has those roots within Gettysburg?
Yeah, I do think that makes sense. I think that that's probably smart. Just from like, there's a alumni expectation standpoint, which like when it is an additional alum, I don't know that it necessarily heightens it, but it might just give them a little bit more leeway when it is someone that they think of as one of their own. I could see them going outside. Just like, I mean, the exact same thing is happening at Hopkins where they kind of went outside, but there's still like strong alumni presence there and he's got to deal with that. But it's such a appealing job just because it's great academics. It's great location, pretty wide variety of majors. It's obviously expensive, but the kids that they're recruiting that kind of fit that person out, that mold, usually are able to afford it with a little bit of help from the school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the interesting, the alumni aspect is interesting. And I was going to make the comparison to Johns Hopkins, which is also a Centennial Conference school and everything else, except for lacrosse.
Yeah.
That like, you know, that was a big, I had people who were in coaching circles and people who were, you know, alums who aren't coaches, but, you know, kind of involved in the sport. Like there was a lot of talk about like the involvement and or lack of involvement of the alums in the process. And like, you know, kudos to Johns Hopkins in some way of like, just kind of like, you know, we don't really care if it's an alum or not. We're just going to get the person we think is the best
fit. Best person. Totally.
So I do wonder if there's going to be an aspect of like the search might be a little bit broader than we think. You know, I don't even know how much it's really gotten in earnest, the search kind of with, you know, so many good coaches still playing right now that, you know, I don't think it's going to be something that's going to be announced this week, like, you know, the Washington College job was. And speaking of which, John Nostrand, Washington College, you know, that's big news that happened this weekend. That's another, you know, job from a program that, you know, is one of the ones that just has a ton of name recognition in the sport. You know, they haven't been what they used to be. And I think there's some concern that those kind of, you know, I've heard people say the small liberal arts kind of schools, just like the future in terms of the economics of the thing aren't maybe as appealing as they used to be. But you can't deny the history of WAC and, you know, some of the potential that's there if it's the right person. And someone who really cares about the program is a Hall of Famer there, I think is the perfect fit for the WAC job. And John Nostrand has tremendous experience. I think kind of coaching in the MIAA is kind of a really natural progression to coaching at WAC. So that's a very strong and interesting hire. I wonder if you have any thoughts there.
Yeah, no, I just think it's such a program with like rich winning culture and like history behind it that for them to be good is going to be good for all of Division III lacrosse and kind of restore some rivalries, which will be fun to watch.
Yeah, if we want to make that War on the Shore great again, would be awesome. And then, you know, at Denison, you know, I was taken off guard when Mike Caravana, he's announced he was stepping down, you know, after a long 2 tenures that he had at Denison. He kind of had a few years off in the middle of his tenure there. You know, Midwest program that, you know, has definitely been synonymous with success at the D3 level. So, you know, I'm not sure which direction they're going to go there, but that's something that, you know, as we wind down on the tournament, will definitely be something to watch. Another high-end Division III job that is open for, you know, and again, it's the question's always like, is it hired a guy who's like a young up-and-coming assistant who's going to, you know, be there for 20 years? Or is it kind of one of those like, you take the person who's been there and has the experience and the head coaching pedigree that's going to lead you there. So, you know, we'll see what happens there.
Yeah. Or ideally you go get both. You go get the head coach with a whole bunch of experience, and then you get an assistant that you can convince to be there for a few years, but go and grind and do a whole bunch of recruiting and all that type of stuff.
So that's our segue into going back to actually talking about the games. And, you know, RIT Colorado College, and this is the one that I think, you know, is going to get lost in the shuffle a little bit, just because, you know, RIT is just so good. And people are going to kind of look past this matchup. And like we said, like, the key will be for RIT. How do you manage that heading into this game and not looking past this matchup? Colorado College is a team that has taken some very good teams to the limit this year. So what is something that should concern you if you're RIT?
If you're RIT, here's exactly what I would do. If I'm Coach Kuhn, here's what I would do. I'm going to walk into my locker room. I'm going to tell my team, listen, we have two huge games. We absolutely have to take care of business in the first one. And we have to do it early because it's going to be hot. It's going to be a long day. And you want to get your guys rested. So you have to tell them that they have to be ultra-focused so that they can come in and be up so much at halftime that by the middle of the third quarter, all their starters are hanging out on the bench getting rested and getting hydrated, starting to focus on their next opponent. And I think if you're Colorado College, you're doing everything you can, obviously, to win this game. And you're going to have to kind of pull a little bit of an Illinois Wesleyan and kind of pick a side. You know, do you want to try and be the team that uses all 80 seconds of the shot clock every single possession? Or do you want to try and out RIT, RIT? You know, I don't know that you can do that. So maybe you're going to try and use all 80 seconds of every shot clock. Maybe you're going to try and just pack it in, run a zone, or, you know, do something to throw them off on defense. Maybe you do the opposite and go in short stick shot or something, but some sort of wrinkle defensively that throws them off and disrupts them. And then I think if we're sitting here and we're saying that Colorado College either wins this game or won this game or keeps it close, then it's partially because Winston Chodnocki, their faceoff kid, is a lot better than we're currently giving him credit for. And I don't know that that's totally true, but that's kind of going to be the case.
The, you know, RIT is the overall number one seed in this bracket, and they were the only team that had a bye in that first round of this smaller than usual tournament, which only featured, like you said, those two pool C bids, one of them still being alive in Christopher Newport. Now, I think the game that, like, might be the most interesting is the last one that we haven't talked about yet, and that's Tufts versus York. Tufts obviously came into this year with all kinds of hype, despite no one ever really knowing if they were going to play or not. You know, they have since played. They have since taken care of business at every step of the way. They have played the Division I team and handled them. They had a difficult matchup in their second round game against St. John Fisher, and they took care of that. So they are less battle-tested in the sense that they played less games. They only had that few weeks at the end of the season where they really got to play their schedule. And despite it being a NESCAC schedule, it was a NESCAC schedule versus teams that were basically gutted of most of their personnel. So there's a lot of the aspect of Tufts that is, you know, normally this year, you know, they would have had these epic games against Amherst. They would have had these epic games against Williams and Wesleyan. They would have had to, like, muscle their way through this NESCAC tournament that is just a bear, you know, with those games on short rest. They don't have that this year, but we know the personnel and we know that they are as talented as a team can possibly be in Division III lacrosse. Then there's York, which is extremely talented. You know, I think it's fair to say that, like, man-to-man, Tufts has more talented players. York, though, is a team that has just been so, like, they're very good, but they're also just so solid, like, top to bottom, extremely well-coached, has had a full year of gameplay, you know, obviously there's some strength of schedule stuff that they wish they had some more games that would have tested them throughout the year. Their one hiccup was against Stevenson. They avenged that in a very convincing manner when you got to their conference tournament. So I don't know what all that makes, but I know it makes for a very interesting matchup here in this Elite Eight portion. And I'll kind of set it up the same way I did for CNU Lynchburg. You know, what's the thing for each team that if they're going to win this game, they need to execute?
I think this game, more so than any other game I've ever been prepared to watch, if one team is able to assert their style of play, they win.
Mm-hmm.
10 out of 10. I really believe it. I think if York can make this a 6-on-6 game, they win this game 10 times out of 10. If Tufts is able to make this a tough style pace game and, you know, is clicking on transition and is able to get you in these awkward scenarios, they win this game 10 times out of 10. And I think it's that simple. It's the total opposite of what I was saying with Lynchburg CNU, where there's one thing that can determine it. There isn't in that CNU Lynchburg game. There's not one thing. There's going to be adjustments made halfway through. That's going to be a chess match.
Mm-hmm.
This game, I don't think, is a chess match. I think if we are sitting here in Tufts 1, we're going to be able to tell exactly why they won. If we're sitting here in York 1, we're going to be able to tell exactly why they won. It's really, really fascinating. There's not many games that are this way where you can pinpoint it on kind of just that one thing. And like you said, you know, I think Tufts probably has a bit of an advantage talent-wise, but I think York has a bit of an advantage organization-wise. And the advantage that Tufts has with their talent is that they get you unorganized. But I think that that can be schemed against a bit to a degree. And, you know, I think this is going to be a really good one. I think people that are kind of just overlooking the Spartans down south coming up and the Jumbos just rolling like they have been might be a little bit surprised.
Now, there's a few things that I want to kind of build on here with this one. Now, were you part of the team then, the York Amherst game?
Yes, yeah, I was coaching that year.
You were coaching that year. What happened in that game, and is there similarities to this one?
Yeah, I think that it's a similar game plan. That was pre-shot clock, mm-hmm. So we were able to like sustain these really long possessions, and then ultimately there would be like a minute possession that resulted in a matchup that, because they had slid and recovered trying to create a whole bunch of turnovers the whole time, that there was no Hawkeye or there was ultimately like a major breakdown or something, and we were able to pull one out. And then defensively, we were able to do a good job of it because we had the ball that sold so much. When they got the ball, they felt like they needed to rush, and a fast pace that is, you know, controlled is really good. But a fast pace that is rushing mostly results in turnovers. And so that was kind of what we saw in that game. But that was definitely an interesting kind of battle of two different styles. And yeah. York kind of has a reputation of being like a slower team, like, you know, which to a degree is true. But they're also the pace that makes sense. You know, like, if it makes sense for them to go and try and run and gun against the team, and maybe that week they run a few extra, you know, transition drills and kind of tell them, like, hey, we want to get out and run, make sure we're linking up the field, you know. And if not, then it's, you know, it's the opposite. Hey, let's not throw that 40-yard pass on a 45-degree angle up the field because we don't need to headwind it, because we don't need to, you know, push a 43 break at all costs.
Now, it's, you know, it's a lot easier said than done to say, like, they need to slow them down in transition. You know, that is like one of those, totally. You know, totally. Oh, it sounds so simple, but this is Tufts we're talking about. And yeah. This is like a team that, you know, I would almost say like this year, it's just a bizarre like ability to execute in transition that Tufts have. You know, I think
Devin was making fun of me. I told him I had convinced myself that there's a chance York wins. He's like, oh my gosh, you're crazy. I was like, come on, man, let a brother believe.
It's – like, it's, you know, and you know, I've, you know, I think Tufts is like, there's just something about the way that they do their business that I just think is so, like, you know, it's a model for, like, what lacrosse should be in terms
I'm excited to see it in person.
Yeah, like, it's just so, like, they're, like, you know, not only are they, like, so sound in everything they do, there's, like, this, they've somehow threaded this weird needle of, like, player individual-led freedom on the field, but also, like, you know, it comes from the coaches, so it's also, you know, very sound and, like, based in, you know, sound schematics, not just, like, some principle of, like, letting your players play.
They so do some, like, funky stuff, man. Like,
yeah,
in transition, they'll send three over, so they'll send two poles and a D mid over, and then all three will eject and sub at the same time. And Bradall is now dodging 3-on-3 in 50 yards of space, and it's like, holy crap! Like, this is a lot of space. This is tough to defend, you know. Then there's other times where it's like the total opposite, and more specifically with St. John's Fisher, who I love. Like, I thought that they had an awesome team. I thought that they were really good this year. They're definitely going to end up with a slew of All-Americans. And they gave up some goals in that game. Up a guy. Like, their decision when Tufts would do that and leave and go sub was to just not sub with them all the time. And they have these midfielders that are pretty good both ways. And they're big, strong, athletic kids. So they're like, all right, just stay and play defense. And Tufts would dodge 4 against 5 and still score. And it's like, you have an extra guy, you can still slide. But they just still find a way to score. And it's like, maybe it ends up being on a feed to the guy that's subbing because you were sliding to someone, and then behind it, the guy comes in, and it's like, now he's open. It's like, you know, it's just, they do some funky stuff that, like you said, they're just kind of letting their guys play and letting them go. I watched that game. I don't know what their sub of offense is. Don't ask me. I can't tell you.
Now, like, with all that being said, like, what is it, who is the personnel, and, you know, personnel-wise and schematic-wise, what is it that York can do in the middle of the field?
Good question. So I think that the key to all of it is not fail clearing. When you fail clear against Tufts, they score on you. A fail clear is a goal the opposite direction. You have your guys that are, like, so spread when you're in the clear. You have pulls off the field and stuff like that, that even if they don't score on you in transition, when you have to crash – and you, like, you end up with wrong matchups and stuff like that, it results in a goal. So you have to, step one, no fail clears. Step number two, it's simpler than just saying, like, midfielders have to get in the hole in transition. Like, it's not just getting in the hole in transition. It's recognizing that Tufts does a better job than anybody in the country of anticipating the whistle and leaking upfield. So York's dodging. York's got a midfielder at X that's dodging and steps in the crease. The other York midfielders need to anticipate that call and be getting to spots faster than they ever have before. Because Tufts LSM is going to know what that call is, anticipate it, maybe even before the referee blows the whistle, and then be leaking up the field trying to start a fast break. And if they can get it to him, it's buckets the other direction. If not, they get it to a short stick below, and he just cuts. And, you know, you have to get in, defend that. If they take a note from St. John Fisher and try and leave an O-Midi from time to time, or even will end up playing a D-Midi from time to time and just having him get in the hole, you know, they may do some interesting stuff and try and mix it up. But it's really about anticipating and trying to get to the box and trying to get your guys in the hole and trying to make sure that you just are anticipating that whistle and stopping those leakers.
Now, you know, it's funny because, like, Tufts has always been a great transition team, but you know, there were stretches this offseason where like the way that they had to practice in terms of restrictions, whether it was in the fall or the spring, like they could only do transition because they couldn't do settled 6-on-6 because of just like they weren't able to be, you know, that many guys on the field or to be all on the same side of the field and stuff. So they actually, like, by weird circumstance, became a better transition team because of the pandemic in terms of the way that they had to prepare this season with the limitations of COVID. So that's just, you know, adding even more fuel to the fire here for what Tufts is. Now,
yeah, I'm excited to see it. I'm excited to see it in person. I never have.
Now, let me, like, so for York, was there a team that got a worse bracket based on how successful they were during the regular season?
I don't think so. I really don't. And I know that part of it is because of the region. I guess I shouldn't say part of it. It is because of the regional aspects of it. But yeah, I mean, that F&M team is a really good team. You know, we talked about Tufts opponents to get there in St. John Fisher. I kind of wish St. John Fisher and F&M were playing this weekend too.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's a tough draw that York got. You know, and it's like one of those things where, like, you know, you hate to bring up problems without solutions. And I don't necessarily have the solution in front of me because of just the weirdness of what this year was and what they had to do bracket wise to kind of make it work with like the geography and the limited number of teams and the host sites and all that stuff that kind of went into this. But man, that's a tough run. And, you know, it kind of feels like York has always had like this team at this round that has just like been just a gauntlet that they have to go through.
Yeah, so when I was coaching, when we did get to here, we had RIT this weekend, and it would have been the opposite. So it would have been RIT Wednesday, Tufts Saturday. And this time it is Tufts Saturday, RIT Sunday. Crazy. One day rest. Man.
Yeah, and that's like, and when I just said all of that, I wasn't even thinking of the fact that if they win, they play RIT on Sunday. You know what I mean? Like, that didn't even cross my mind. That's just how, like, crazy. Like, F&M is really good. I thought that was a game that, like, you know, I don't know who, we didn't really do picks. I don't know who I would have picked in that. I might have picked F&M for that second round when we were going into the game.
Hey, man, I won't hold it against you.
I know. I'm kind of breaking your heart right now. But, you know, kudos to them for getting through it. And, hey, it's just going to make them, you know, every team is going to be to the next round so much stronger than they were the day before, unless there's injuries or something like that. Like, you know, if York beats Tufts, they're going to be, like, playing the best version of York lacrosse on Sunday when they play RIT.
Totally.
Like, it's just going to be, like, it's going to have such a momentum effect that, like, it is building to having an awesome championship weekend in terms of, you know, teams being the best versions of themselves.
Yeah, I also think that they're similar enough that, like, you can kind of just go, like, go do it again. Do what you did yesterday again today, you know, between Tufts and RIT.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the D2 bracket because, like, this is, like, a really, really just unique and interesting Final Four that we have in D2 men's lacrosse. And, it's, you know, they're kind of at a different – obviously, the size of the tournament is smaller, so they're at a different phase of the tournament this weekend than the D3 is. So they just have the one game. You know, they have the Final Four game of, yeah, Lemoyne versus Mercyhurst in, you know, what you'd call the North region. And then – you have Wingate versus Lenoir Ryan in the South, and the games that Lenoir Ryan and Wingate won to get to this point were just, like, absolutely bananas. And, like, it's one of those things that, like, I don't know what's going to be able to, like, top that in terms of, like, from, like, a fun spectator perspective because, you know, you look at Lenoir Ryan, who is a team that I think we've both at certain points of this year been like, this is a team that looks like a national championship team. And a freshman scores with 4 seconds left in overtime, giving them the trip to the NCAA semifinals. It's going to be their second trip here to the semis. He's a freshman who, like, you know, he's not someone who's, like, had a ton of goals either. You know, he's only had a few goals on the year. And they were down by as many as 5 goals at halftime. You know, not 5 goals in, you know, early in the first quarter. They were down 5 goals at halftime and came back and beat, you know, not some team that was, like, giving them a surprising run, but Tampa, a team that was, you know, number 2 in our rankings for, I think, from the very beginning. And I know Kyle and I had arguments over which team should be number 1 between them and Lemoyne, and I kept vouching for Lemoyne. Like, Tampa's an amazing team. You know, there's a ton of D1 players on that roster who transferred in and kind of just, like, they're always so talented at the top end. They have an amazing faceoff specialist, which was a key theme in this game as well. And Lenore Ryan just found a way to win. And, like, they always seem to, like, do that in terms of, like, these, like, games that are, like, super high scoring and, like, you know, nearing 30, 40 goals that are, like, feature these wild momentum swings. I feel like they always go, like, Lenore Ryan's way, which just says something a lot about, I think, the character of the team that they're able to do that. And then Wingate on the other side, you know, Wingate is a team, Wingate on, you know, the other side of their matchup, you know, they're playing each other. Wingate beat them in April. So, like, you know, they beat them in April. Lenore Ryan came back and won it in the South Atlantic Conference tournament, you know, just a few weeks ago. That was a 19-14 win by Lenore Ryan. So, like, I don't really know what to predict here. You know, Wingate's got a little, Lenore Ryan at this point, I feel like, is kind of crossed that threshold into, like, you know, they are a team to beat in the South. You know, they're up there as a contender. Wingate, like, has been, had, you know, some really awesome years. This is their furthest that they've been is to the semifinals. You know, they're kind of more on the cusp, I would say. Tim Boyle is coaching there. He was the head coach at Dowling, national championship program that shuttered a few years back, and he's done some awesome stuff at Wingate since he's taken over. So I don't really, like, know how to break down this matchup other than it's two teams that are very familiar with each other. The games have been, you know, of the higher scoring variety. Both are coming off of games that they won, you know, in some dramatic fashion. You know, Lenore Ryan's was, like we just talked about, this epic comeback that was in overtime. Wingate, they too, like, had to have a heroic win. It was a 10-9 win over UIndy, and it was a sophomore who scored the game winner with 8 seconds left. This is going to be an awesome one. You know, I think I'm more looking forward to the South side of the bracket in terms of just, like, you know, either one of these teams would be their first time going to the NCAA championship. They, you know, both have a little more of that Cinderella aspect to them to some degree. And then, you know, you look at the North, and I don't know, like, what that does. And maybe you'd have some insight just from your, like, you know, being more of a player who's been in these kind of spots. First advance to the semifinal round where they're going to play Lemoyne. You know, Lemoyne is essentially the class of Division II lacrosse. Lemoyne is the team that, you know, in a similar way to, like, a Salisbury or Tufts, at the beginning of the year, if you say Lemoyne's going to win it all, it's probably a safe bet. You know, you should always put money on them if they're, for whatever reason, a double-digit, like, odds team. Mercyhurst did not play in their quarterfinal round because Mercy, the team that they're supposed to play, had to withdraw because of COVID protocol. So that game was a no contest. So Mercyhurst is sitting here not having really played since May 8th, they won against Seton Hill in their conference tournament. And now they're sticking down the barrel of Lemoyne. What, in terms of, like, what's your take on the, like, rest versus rust debate when it comes to this?
Oh, I think in the tournament, it becomes more of a rest, more of a benefit where you can get that rest. I think in the middle of the season, it hurts you. But right now, I think focus is at such a high level and the stakes are so high that rust isn't really, like, it's just not going to happen. Maybe if you're a team that has played 4 games on the season, 5 games on the season, But at this point, they have enough games under their belt. There's enough chemistry there. The focus level should be high enough that I don't think it results in any rust. And I do think that you're getting some of your legs back. Maybe you're a little bit banged up from your conference tournament run. And it's just giving you a little bit of time to kind of get healed up, get some rest on your legs, and that type of stuff, maintenance, and keep getting chopped up and all that type of stuff, keeping your stick work right, but less grinding on your body.
Yeah, and Mercyhurst is a team, they played 13 games. So, it's not like they're in a situation where, they've only played 6 or 7 games and they're right. So they played 13 games. Their one loss was against Mercy, which is kind of an interesting wrinkle to all this, is that they didn't get to play the one team that knocked them off.
Robbed of the rematch.
Yeah. So I don't know, but LeMoyne is just I've just never seen a team so well coached consistently than LeMoyne. And this is not saying that Dan Sheehan is going to coach a better game than Chris Ryan, because they're both coaches who are national championship winning coaches at the elite level of where they're at. But just I look at this year with LeMoyne and, they've never I don't want to say they win ugly all the time, because that's it's really downplaying what they do. They win efficiently in the sense that they are never too high, too low. They've had games where they've scored. They've just, won a shootout. I think of Adelphi, which had the craziest finish to any game this year.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I remember you sent me a Slack, LeMoyne Adelphi in OT. I turned it on, and then there was that crazy sequence at the end of the game where LeMoyne ended up winning it. They've done that. But then they've also done these games when they beat St. A's in the NE10 tournament. It was a 9-4 win. They're just such a business team where I think Mercyhurst is taking care of business, but they're a little more of a little more swagger to them this year, I would say. Whereas LeMoyne's a little more just this is what we do. We just come in and we figure out the way that we're gonna win and we do that. So I don't know how that's gonna manifest itself on game day, but I'm really excited for it. I'm really more excited for the South matchup in the sense that I think that's going to be one of those 16-14 victory either way. And it's just fun to watch some, those teams have those wild up and down moments. But Mercyhurst, there's a possibility, I guess, that Mercyhurst can kind of uncork a huge offensive day, Nathan Grennan and Caleb Cuber are just some awesome players that can, really score a lot of goals. I think Grennan has something 30 goals. Cuber is a guy who has over 50 goals. So they're definitely people who can put the ball in the back of the net, and they got a face-off guy in Doran who can, definitely overwhelm a team with possession. But LeMoyne, man, LeMoyne is one of those teams that I don't care who the players are, who the personnel is, I have a tough time picking against them, which is just a weird thing to say. But sometimes there are teams that are just like that.
Yeah, they just find a way to squeak it out, even in tight ones. They find a way to win them. And to your point, that very much so has to do with coaching.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, both national championship winners. LeMoyne has won a bunch of them. Mercyhurst has won one national championship. So a little more of a pedigree of, success at the highest level here at the North bracket. But that's all going to be fun. Those games are on Sunday. So the D3 games, it's going to be, you're going to be up there at the Rochester bracket on Saturday. And then also Sunday, they're going to play the semifinal round. So like we said, back to back, there's not going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a total win-win for me, because if I'm going up, and if York happens to win on Saturday, I'll get to be there for that and watch that, which will be obviously electric. And if they lose, I'll pout for a few minutes and then just be excited to watch Tufts RIT on Sunday.
That's awesome. I don't know if fortunately or unfortunately is where I want to go here, but this happens once every 4 years or so here. And it's I have a wedding to go to.
Oh,
Saturday. So,
gosh,
and it's like it's one of those weddings where it's like the worst time possible. It starts at 3.
Oof.
So, yeah.
You're going to be the, like, total guy in the crowd with your phone, like, trying to sneak it and then see something happen and just be, like, under your breath, like, oh, my God. Interrupt the guy doing the ceremony, whatever you want to call him.
Well, the good thing is it's, like, it's a very informal wedding. You know,
there you go.
Like, I'm old enough now where, like, the weddings I go to aren't, like, people who met in college and, like, are, you know, having their traditional big wedding. These are my neighbors who are having, they've lived together for like 15 years. They have kids from a prior marriage and are just like basically making it formal.
I feel like you could just be like, hey guys, listen, I like you. You're my friends. I think you like me enough to know that my thoughts are with you, but my presence is not going to be.
Yeah, like, I don't know if anyone has ever used the, like, you know, I'm going to have to decline my invitation that there's deep quarterfinals on excuse. But I think I'll at least find a way to sneak it in and watch later while you kind of take care of all the stuff on Saturday, you know, and then I'll kind of circle back on Sunday morning. So that's very frustrating for me, but I will do my best to follow along and then catch up with it after the fact. I'm sure my phone will be blowing up on Saturday like it always is in May.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I'm being a big baby about it.
I don't know that I wouldn't be. I would be pouting big time. I probably would have talked about it at least 5 or 6 times by this point in the podcast.
Well, and this is one of those, you know, like, we have a babysitter for the kids.
Oh, yeah. That's
if
true.
If I, like, weaseled my way out of this, after working all of the weekends, you know, since the end of January, I would be looking at a divorce right now. I have to take one for the team here for this one. So, ending on a sour note, but I'm still excited. So, like, I'm still excited for these games. I'm still excited for all these players. We're into May. The best games of the year are all happening right in front of us still. There's going to be fans at a lot of these. Life is good.
Yeah, that Lenore Ryan game winner with the fans in the background, it's just electric factory.
Yeah, like, I know we're going on a tangent. We've kind of, like, the last 10 minutes have kind of just, like, gone off the rails. But, like, that crowd was awesome at Lenore Ryan.
Oh, my gosh.
And that stadium, that is a sports school. Like, that is a school that, like, really cares about its athletics. That was so cool. And, like, the fact that they, like, you know, props to them for, like, investing the money into the, like, coverage of these games, because they had multiple angles of that game-winning goal. They had awesome graphics. You know, they had, and that stuff was, like, coming in real time, too. Right. You know what I mean? It was, like, it wasn't so, like, really great job by their athletic department and their communications. And, you know, I don't know who it was who took that video, because it's really awesome stuff. But just awesome job, like, because that's the way that, like, you know, you can really make a difference at one of these schools, you know, a D2 or D3 school particularly, by standing out from the crowd in those ways. Totally. Like, if you've got, like, an awesome social media presence, you have, like, showing that experience, I want to go play it. Like, that's just, like, one of those things where, like, I want to be a part of that. And they showed it to everyone. And there's definitely kids who, like, are on Lax Twitter or Lax Instagram who saw that and looked up the school, or, you know, like, or texted their buddy who, like, maybe went on a recruiting visit there or something like that, and are interested in that school right now.
Absolutely. 100%.
So, all right. Well, this is fun. A nice early morning edition of the D2 D3 podcast. We're going to get rolling on the week, and make sure, Dan, where can people follow you on Saturday while you're, you know, on the fields there?
Find me at dkaplan46. And you could be my 1,001 follower. I happened to notice that this morning. I woke up, I checked Twitter, and I'm officially in the 1,000 club.
Awesome. And you can follow me at Matt Kinnear for wedding play-by-play on Saturday. And then, you know, on Sunday, I'll be, I think, focusing much of my attention on those D2 semifinal games. So follow me there for that. So this is awesome. Dan, thanks a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
what she'd get. Man, when I tell you she was cool, she was red hot. I mean, she was steaming.